Today on New Horizons, Boise State Education Professor Lewis Nadelson talking about efforts to improve math and science education in America's schools.
Probably the biggest issue is that science and math are challenging subjects to learn, and we're still working on what is most effective. It's critical that we continue to offer professional development to capitalize on what we know about how people learn and utilize that in practice in the classroom. We're really struggling with recruiting people who want to teach physics or teach chemistry. And what we've got to do is really help people understand that teaching can be a very rewarding career.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. In our fast-moving global economy, the importance of preparing the next generation of students to excel in math and science cannot be overstated. Yet despite a growing awareness of the importance of math and science education, America's students continue to lag behind their counterparts in many other countries on test scores in these critical areas of study. My guest, Boise State Education Professor Lewis Nadelson, has spent much of his career teaching teachers the most effective methods to help students learn math and science. In 2008, Dr. Nadelson was tasked with studying the effectiveness of the new Idaho Systemic Solution, a project funded by the U.S. Department of Education to support elementary school teachers. Dr. Nadelson is a former high school math and science teacher. He holds bachelor's degrees from Colorado State University and Evergreen State College, a master's degree from Western Washington University, and a doctorate in educational psychology from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Lewis Nadelson, welcome to New Horizons.
Thank you, Bob. Pleasure to be here.
This is going to be a fascinating show, and we're not going to have time for everything I'd like to talk about, but let me set it up this way. I'd like to address one topic that probably will not govern the rest of our discussion. The rest of our discussion will really focus on, regardless of where we stand internationally, we owe it to our students and to their parents to provide the most effective teaching methods in the classroom and achieve the desired results. That's the work you're doing, and I much appreciate it. Before we get there, though, as an overview for those of us just watching this international game of competition when it comes to math and science achievement across the globe, what does account for American students lagging behind their counterparts? If you could help us identify those factors, how long has this been going on? What kind of hope do you see for the future? And then we'll get into some. I want to talk about your research as well, because that's probably critical to answering some of these this larger question I've just asked you.
Right, absolutely. You know, that is an interesting question. We bring in these elementary school students, and they're really excited, engaged in science learning, and then over time, their engagement and excitement for science, math, kind of dwindles, and other things seem to take its place. And so, in terms of a quick answer of why that happens, it's a complex system, and it's not any one thing that you can point to and say, this is the reason why that happens. A lot of it has to do with how school takes place internationally versus how it takes place here in the United States. There are different approaches to education, different best practices. Many of the schools and school systems, nations, and so forth worldwide don't have the same kind of emphasis on achievement that we may find with U.S. schools, especially associated with the No Child Left Behind initiative, which has had such a tremendous focus on math and English language arts, leaving science and other topics as being secondary, if not completely left out of the curriculum, which has not helped our performance in terms of internationally. The other thing is that science is tough to teach. It's a tough topic. There's lots of different parts to it. There's, the best practices will involve hands-on activities. It'll involve content. It'll involve vocabulary. All of these which need to start day one. Well, if we're not preparing our elementary school teachers to teach science, then the students may do okay with that, but then their doing okay leaves them behind internationally if they're not excelling. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's part of the pipeline there. We've got to make sure our teachers are prepared to teach those students. The students then learn the foundational knowledge, which will then carry them through. And so that's one of those components there. The other component is you know, the nature of those tests, who's being tested and so forth. If we bring out, you know, a comparable group of students, the best and the brightest, that some of the other nations will test, we'll also find that we're very competitive at that level. But we have a commitment to educate everybody, and everybody is part of those tests. And so as a result, what we're seeing in those tests may not be reflective of what other people are testing as well. So we've got to keep that in perspective and realize that there may not be, you know, parallel or comparable testing samples and populations there in terms of the general public. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that accounts for some of that as well. Mm-hmm. But probably the biggest issue is that science and math are challenging subjects to learn, and we have to go about it in a way that's going to be most effective. And we're still working on what is most effective. I mean, we're still trying to figure out how do people learn best, and we're making some real good progress with that. But then taking that from our theoretical understanding based on our research into practice is the next phase in assuring that we can sustain those kind of levels of interest and engagement in math and science education and in other areas as well.
The first part of your answer, you said something like how schooling takes place internationally. And I must admit, as a layman on this subject, that's certainly something that grabs me, because we hear these stories in the media about, first of all, the length of the school day in places like China. We hear stories about the discipline exerted on students by parents and their families. I remember reading one study of Vietnamese children from lower socioeconomic backgrounds in the Los Angeles area. It was a study done a number of years ago trying to figure out why they were scoring so high when socioeconomics would tell you these kids weren't going to do very well in the classroom. They found out that every night after dinner, the family sat around the table for 2 hours and there was study hour. Now, I'd like to know how many American homes have a 2-hour study hour after dinner. Frankly, most of them don't even have dinner for the family anymore. So the fact is, I'm pretty pessimistic on this subject. I mean, I want to get to your teaching methods in a moment, and I do understand the importance of that. But what really concerns me is that I don't think we have the national will to really deal internationally with what's before us. And I don't think we've wrapped this subject in the American flag nearly enough. It made it a patriotic issue, like we either step up to the plate, invest in math and science education, or we stay falling behind as we've been doing for a number of years. Now, I don't mean to give a speech, but I guess I'm just curious if you agree that part of this challenge is not just the teacher and not just those like yourself who are teaching the teacher, but lots of other factors that weigh into this thing.
Yeah, as I stated earlier, it's an incredibly complex system. It does involve the family. It involves the students. It involves the teachers. It involves the community. It involves the government, policy, the school districts, the institutions of higher education. I mean, it's got to be a collaborative effort, and we've got to understand that. And some of these variables are very much out of our control as well. You know, how family dynamics take place is a, you know, very much a personal choice. We can make recommendations and we can help foster some of those, you know, the study at right. night kind of activities. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you know, a lot of that is going to be up to individual choice and priorities too. Mm-hmm. Some people just don't have that flexibility in their lifestyle to mm-hmm. do some of that.
Well, in the meantime, let's talk about the American student. When does the American student in school start falling behind? Can you pinpoint that in your research?
Well, one of my favorite things to say is that it's in middle school where the wheels fall off.
Okay. All right.
You know, that seems to be where it happens. And I've been intrigued by this and have been looking at, you know, into doing, you know, and I've been doing some research in this and looking into why that is. And a couple of different things happen at the middle school level. First of all, science goes from being this kind of hands-on, maybe almost supplementary activity or something that is an exciting kind of activity, to now a mandated subject. And unless it's taught with the same kind of excitement and the same kind of interest that may be happening at the elementary level, that kind of student engagement that's required for that kind of learning that's happening at the elementary level isn't going to be sustained. And so, you know, part of that is that we're trying to formalize the academic presentation of science, and so it becomes a lot more textbook-oriented, more worksheet-oriented, becomes much more vocabulary-oriented, and so less activity-oriented. And so we know in the science education community that it's critical that we do something about this. And so there's this real big emphasis on inquiry as part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And it's a national mandate from the National Research Council, from the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the National Science Teacher Association, that we really look at how we're teaching science so that we are engaging students in an inquiry kind of atmosphere. The other thing that happens in middle school, too, is that we get a shift because of our culture in who's important in the students' lives, going from the parent and teacher as the kind of authority figure and the important part of a student's life to much more of a reliance on peers. Mm. And when that shift happens, we find that the students become much more social in their interests and less academic in their interests. And it's tough to capitalize on that because that's a societal kind of a situation, and it's also a growth kind of a situation. Now, other countries, the students are faced with some of that as well, but because of their culture, it's less emphasized than it is here in the United States.
Let me add a third in the form of a question, because I'm not sure of this, but do we have enough teachers specifically trained and educated in math and science, especially teaching math and science in the middle school, as opposed to the generalist that just wanders up from the elementary grades and really doesn't have the techniques or the expertise that you might need for those critical middle school years?
That is a critical issue that is a nationwide issue, that most states will certify teachers as either a K through 8 teacher or a secondary teacher, which, you know, is essentially a 6 through 12 teacher. And so there's this overlap in the middle school, junior high schools, where you can have a teacher who is certified to teach that area, but has been prepared with an elementary curriculum instead of maybe the same kind of a curriculum where they specialize perhaps in math or science education. Because of that, they will have to spend a lot more time preparing, a lot more time in professional development to catch up with their peers that have been prepared specifically in math and science education. So the answer to your question is yes. there is an issue with that. And it's critical that we continue to offer professional development to help those teachers become well-prepared to teach best practices, but also with the content knowledge and understanding of how to teach using inquiry methods and how to teach using the engagement kind of methods that are part of the mathematical thinking initiative and so forth, that capitalize on what we know about how people learn and utilize that in practice in the classroom. It's an ongoing, lifelong process. Mm-hmm.
Just a few years ago, there was a study on the senior year. There was a national commission on the senior year, and you've been in the trenches. I have not, but I have visited enough high schools in my past. Now, I must say that this does not include Idaho high schools. This is my Illinois and my Kentucky experience, but boy, you go into these senior classes, and the bell rings at 12:30, 1 o'clock, and you see all the seniors leaving the building, and you have to wonder, is that part of the problem, that really if test scores are flat in high school, maybe it has something to do with the fact that we're letting them out at some point way too early? And again, going back to time on task, you need to do that, don't you?
I you can really get me on my soapbox with that one as well, because I saw the same thing when I was teaching high school. You know, I taught high school for over 15 years, and the same thing, happened, and I taught in 4 different buildings, and, you know, that was the same kind of a situation throughout those same buildings, is that it was kind of almost a rite of passage that when you hit your senior year, you don't have to go to school as much and you can get out early. And instead of looking at it as an opportunity, or we really need to keep these students here in school so we can help prepare them, especially if they're going to go on to college, we're teaching remedial math classes post-secondary that we could have taken care of in secondary if we got the commitment of those students and their parents to keep them in school there. So, you know, that is part of the issue there, too. You know, and part of the issue, I think, also is a lot of times teaching this stuff in context that is meaningful and interesting and engaging for students as well. Mm-hmm. You know, the disjointed curriculum is a tough one to to find very compelling when you're a teenager.
Well, when you were describing the problems with science courses, I thought, I can remember the frog in biology, but past that, I can't remember those hours upon hours I had to just memorize terms that bore no relationship to science discovery and the things you're trying to teach. You're listening to Lewis Nadelson. He is an education professor here at Boise State, and most importantly, he helps teachers teach math and science more effectively. Lewis, let's talk about the Idaho systemic solution, what you're doing here in Idaho to help teachers teach math and science more effectively.
Absolutely. This is a pretty exciting project here. It's a collaboration between the College of Education, the College of Engineering, and a local company called PCS Adventures. And we're working collaboratively to provide hands-on manipulatives, the brick labs, their Lego-like bricks, to teach teachers how to engage their students in these fun activities. These brick labs go into the schools and the students are, you know, it's like the Pied Piper there, you know, the students just find those bricks and they're very compelling. They're following them around to find out where they're going because they're excited about them and they want to do something with them. And so it's a very engaging kind of activity there. So the students are very interested in it. What we want to do is teach the teachers how to use those using best practices to really enhance learning. And so part of this initiative is to look at, you know, their confidence in teaching mathematics and science, their efficacy for teaching mathematics and science, their interest in doing this. And so through a summer institute, we will prepare them to do these best practices and do some explanations and workshop on how people learn and make this a really engaging hands-on kind of activities through this summer institute, and then follow up through the school year with continued professional development. And then we've been gathering data as we've done this and to find out how is this influencing how they teach and their perceptions of teaching math and science. And we're having some really positive results. We've published a paper on this that shows significant gains just in the time of that summer institute, you know, just becoming familiar with it and increases in their abilities and understanding with that. So we've been funded again, and we're going into our second year of this, and we're going to use our first year teachers as mentors with this project. And so we can kind of make this into a self-sustaining project and program.
Help us understand the inquiry-based approach to teaching math and science. How is that going to differ from what most of us remember from our days, as I said, mostly learning labels and titles and definitions of things?
Right. Inquiry means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And so that's a tough one to define because it is somewhat nebulous. But the general idea of inquiry is to engage students in a situation where they are either presented with a question or ask, you know, they've asked their own question, and they're provided with the tools or means of solving that question, finding a solution to it, gathering some data, examining the results, and then reporting on those. For example, you know, I've used a lot of these in my science methods class that I'm teaching right now for pre-service teachers. One of the questions I went in there with them is, what paper towel is the best paper towel? And so brought in a half a dozen brands of paper towel and put them down and said, what paper towel is the best paper towel? And then let them define what best was and how they were going to test it and how they gathered data and what their report was and what their conclusion was. So I can model that for them so they can then take that into the classroom. And so, you know, asking those kinds of questions where they're pretty open-ended like that and then helping them go through that process. It's very important that we model that at first for students because they need to understand how they go about solving their own questions. If they're just thrown in there with that, they probably won't do very well. But if you model it enough for them, they'll understand, oh, this is the process of being a scientist is essentially what it is. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really powerful instructional tool especially when it's scaffolded in a way that it's guided at first and then the student gets more and more responsibility for that inquiry process, they will eventually maybe they're at a point where they can conduct their own inquiry from beginning to end. Probably the best example of a lot of those is the science fair project. But it can be the whole class may be working on a specific guided activity, like I gave with the, you know, the paper towels and so forth with that, that they could be working on that together. And the power of that then is they see what science is, they see how you go about collecting data, and they see how the creative process of it, the systematic collection of data, how you interpret that. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, you know, it gets them engaged. And we know about learning is that higher levels of engagement lead to higher levels of understanding and higher levels of motivation. And then it would also help with their retention with that as well. And then it will help, hopefully, dissipate some of the fear with science, too, because that gives a whole different way to how we view science.
Mm-hmm. I can get really optimistic and excited about what I hear you're doing and the impact you're having on the teachers you get to work with and the students they get to work with. Where I get nervous is wondering how many you're reaching and how many your colleagues are reaching. Most importantly, how many go unreached, so to speak. And it poses questions like, is this message and this approach that you're taking getting into the national administration, the U.S. Department of Education? Has there been any shift even since this new administration has taken over? Any signs that what you're doing here has the potential of being a national movement and not something that's touching a few students in Boise?
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's really interesting. I belong to several science and math organizations, professional organizations, science and math, I should say, teacher and teaching professional organizations. And there is a lot of excitement about the support that math, science, engineering, technology is getting and the support and attention that it's getting that it hasn't had for a while in the current administration. And so there's a lot of support in the current administration. But you know, the interest in this has been coming from a number of different sources. And like I said, the National Science Education Standards that were put out in 1996 by the National Research Council have been a real driving force. They put out then a book on inquiry in 2000 to help support that document. So there's a growing support for that from the National Research Council, which is part of the National Academies of Science. But in addition to that, we're not alone in you know, me and my colleagues and so forth. This is a national issue. And so part of this national issue, the Association of Public and Land-Grant Colleges, APLU, has come up with something called the Science Math Teacher Imperative. And the goal of this is to help examine what are we doing in colleges of higher education to prepare science and math teachers. And how can we do that better? How can we do better at recruiting those teachers? How can we do better at preparing them? And how can we do better at sustaining their professional development? And so we at Boise State have become part of this SMTI, the Science Math Teacher Imperative, as you know. And part of that, then, is we are part of the leadership collaborative in that. So we're not only part of this 108 colleges or college university systems in the United States, we're part of the 27 colleges or college system leaders in this group. And so that is an important statement. And part of that is to get that critical mass so that we can go to Washington and say, look, this is what we need to make this happen. This is mm-hmm. what we need to make sure that we are preparing teachers, not just locally, but regionally, nationally, at a level that's going to be necessary and sustained.
And I probably should add on that one, the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities is historically the large public research universities and land-grant universities of America that came together in this association. Boise State has only been a member of this organization for a few years since we are aspiring to become the kind of university you think of when you think of the University of Minnesota or the University of Utah. What's really impressive is that in the short time we've been there, you and your colleagues, including Barbara Morgan, our astronaut educator, has managed to play a major leadership role in this organization. And again, focusing on the recruitment issue, I'd like your elaboration on that a little bit, because it does seem to me that so many of our really top students think about medical careers. I'll be a doctor. I'll go get a doctorate, and I'll go do research and teach at a university. Getting students to turn around and focus on elementary and secondary education, math and science in particular, that's really the challenge, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And it's, you know, we do a pretty good job at recruiting some students better than others. And just that we can easily recruit elementary teachers. There's a lot of people that are very interested in elementary teaching. So we're doing a really good job at recruiting those. We're really struggling with recruiting people who want to teach physics or teach chemistry. And, you know, part of that is the culture of, you know, what are you going to, you're going to go be a chemistry teacher. Why don't you go be a chemist? And you can make a lot more money and have all this other, you know, kind of life perks if you do that. And what we've got to do is really help people understand that it's teaching can be a very rewarding career, and give them that experience so that by getting that experience, perhaps they'll move past, you know, looking at, well, I want to be a chemist, to I want to teach chemistry, because this is an exciting job. This is a very interesting, you know, career. I like working with people. I like working with these students. I'm seeing this tremendous kind of change in them, and I can make a difference. To try and ignite that kind of excitement in the students is part of helping that recruitment effort. But it is, you know, that is a challenge right now. Mm-hmm. We've been working with the NSF NOICE grant to try and recruit people through a substantial scholarship project, and we're going to continue to sustain that next year, and we'll apply for the next round in mm-hmm. doing that. But that happens to be an issue for everybody in the APLU. We're not alone in that issue.
Sure.
So it's, you know, how do we deal with that? Mm-hmm.
Given the priority of this issue, is there any signs that this recession we're in may have an impact on some aspects of it? I mean, certainly when it comes to rewarding or compensating teachers appropriately for their work, that's going to get hit straight up. I mean, how could it not? But I wonder, in terms of your research, in terms of the research of your colleagues, have you seen any cutbacks in the availability of resources for what you're doing?
Well, you know, that's interesting. Part of this is that stimulus package that's being promoted is there's been a tremendous amount of money that's being put toward science, math, teacher education. And so the National Science Foundation has had an influx of billions of dollars to try and support programs that are serving this, as well as the National Institute of Health and, you know, the other programs that have received the funding to make this happen. Where I think we're still struggling is on the local level, the state level, to try and support the teachers with their salaries and so forth. In terms of research and in terms of, you know, getting the best practices out there and finding some different ways to do what we're doing that are much more effective, that possibility is just really exploding. It's mm-hmm. But what are we going to do with that if we can't support the teachers locally? It's right. going to be a much bigger issue that mm-hmm. we're going to have to eventually deal with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've ended on a perfect note, a note of optimism at first, and then a note of caution that we've got a lot of work to do with our local legislature, our state legislature, when it comes to getting adequate funding for teachers and the work that you're doing. Lewis Nadelson, thank you for what you do for Boise State University, its students, most importantly for the teachers out there on the front lines teaching our students. You're making great progress, and we really appreciate your work.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Lewis Nadelson joining us today on New Horizons. Next week, Idaho State University's Philip Homan talking about Kitty Wilkins, the Horse Queen of Idaho. You're not going to get that on Charlie Rose or Terry Gross. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research provided by Julie Hahn. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.